Downloads of the show are available at Podomatic.com or the Podomatic mobile app. Hey, kids. You are listening to Radio Free Brooklyn, and this show is Fish Out of Agua with Michelle Carlo. Today is Tuesday, August 28, 2018. And summer's almost over, kids. Well, not actual summer. That doesn't end until September 23rd. But, you know, media-manufactured Memorial Day, which is really in the spring, till Labor Day summer. How was yours? It's been strange for me. A lot of weird things have been going on, people having health issues, losing people, and I'm sure it's the same for you. I don't know. And then plus it rained almost every weekend. I guess maybe you could say it's been a kind of a cruel summer, wouldn't you? And we're back with Fish Out of Agua on Radio Free Brooklyn. That was British new wave synth pop girl band Bananarama with Cruel Summer which was originally a single in the infamous summer of 1984, but was then so popular it was included in their self-titled debut album the next year in 1985. Well, kids, we have a lot of show for you as usual, which I can't wait to get to. But first, I'd like to include another song, jumping ahead about a decade and a half, that this week's guest artist handpicked to open their episode. And we're back with Fish Out of Agua on Radio Free Brooklyn. That was the Bronx's own Jennifer Lopez with Waiting for Tonight from her On the Six album back in 1999. Wow, that song brings me back. Oh my God, I think of it as a summer song, but I looked it up and it actually came out in October. Maybe it was a summer song for the year 2000. Ooh, Y2K. Such a long time ago, wasn't it, kids? Well, we're getting back to the present now, because now it's time for my favorite part of the show. Whoa, whoa. Everybody, welcome to Fish Out of Agua's Guest Artist of the Week! Woohoo! We have a fantastic guest artist for you today. Someone who I've been trying to get on the show forever. So please welcome a fantastic storyteller, writer, producer, actress, and I'm sure other fantastic things she will tell me that I forgot to say. Anita Flores, fellow Latina. I'm getting all my Latin ladies on this show, trust me.
I love it. I want to see more Latinas.
Yes, everywhere. Más Latina. y más Latina. And more.
More Latinas.
And more. So I thought that we didn't know each other very long, but a little pre-conversation uncovered the fact that we actually met about 3 or 4 years ago.
I would agree with that. However, I do suspect that I probably had seen you perform before and we had never spoken after. So I feel like I know you and I've known you for longer because I know for a fact that I've seen you perform before we met.
And the same thing, igual, the same me with you. Like, I would see you around.
Yeah.
So, but we have figured out that the conduit for us actually being together on the same show was Harmon Leon's Tail show when he did it downstairs at Three of Cups.
Yes.
Which is no longer around. Three of Cups closed down earlier this year. Yeah, everything closes, Anita. My East Village is no longer the East Village. Oh my God. Whatever. Cities adapt, they evolve, you know, do we.
I wish I could have seen your East Village.
But you know, I also have a saying, it's never going to be as good as it was.
Sure.
But it's never going to be as good as it's going to be.
I mean, that's a really positive outlook, and I hope that that is true.
Let's talk about you. I do know that you're not a native New Yorker, and are you all Latina?
Two big things, because you are a native New Yorker, you can tell me if technically I am a native New Yorker, because I was born in Queens.
Okay. Ooh, what neighborhood?
Flushing. So I lived there with my parents until I was 7 years old. They couldn't afford it anymore. So my mother's family, who lived in Connecticut, said, hey, we'll help you pay for things if you move to Connecticut. So I moved to Connecticut, and then I was there from age 8 to, 17. Then I moved around to a bunch of colleges, and eventually I came back to New York at age 20, and I'm 30 now.
You qualify as a native New Yorker.
Yes!
Being a native New Yorker, in my book, means that you were born here, and you went to some grade school here. Because I always say, if you can survive a New York City public or Catholic schoolyard, you can survive anything.
I think that's absolutely true. And now I'm coming up on my came back to New York anniversary. Or no, I already passed it of 10 years.
So Connecticut and New York, the two very disparate places to grow up.
Very different.
Well, we'll get into some of the differences between that in a little bit.
So in terms of my background, so my mother is from Connecticut. She is Jewish, Lithuanian, white. My father is from Peru. He's Peruvian. He was born in Lima. So if you find me on Twitter, I'm Anita Jutina because I'm Jewish and Latina.
Oh, I love that.
Yes. Very happy to be, especially be Latina on my dad's side because I think Flores, in my opinion, is a great last name.
Sure. Flowers. Anita Flowers.
Anita Flowers. If I had my mom's last name, I'd be Anita Rapkin, which just doesn't have the same ring, you know.
Well, but a lot of comedians have names that sound like that. The one that came to my mind immediately was Gilda Radner.
Ooh, yeah, good point. I definitely know a lot of things about her, but, you know, I didn't grow up in that era, and I feel like I need to do some research.
So, Anita, do you come from a performance or education-oriented family?
So,
artistic?
That's a good question. My dad has, to me, what I would call a fascinating trajectory, because he went from, he very early on knew he wanted to travel. So he left Peru pretty early, around college time, and then finished college in El Salvador.
When was he there?
This was a long time ago. 70s.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Because he's 65. So then after he left, I want to say he got a degree in journalism. But what I do know he went on to do, the two things that he did spend the most time doing, at least to support our family, was he worked for Guerlain, which no longer exists, as a perfume salesman. So before that, no, these are important things. He was a radio DJ. He did amateur boxing. And then he's a very smart guy. I mean, he speaks Spanish, French, and English. So when we moved to Connecticut, he actually worked as a substitute teacher, teaching Spanish and French.
Wow. When did he come to the U.S.?
He came to the U.S., I want to say, in, like, 83. And he actually met my mom at the airport. It was during a layover. I always feel bad ruining it. They are divorced. However, still friends, live very close to one another. And then my mom, I feel like she went to school for writing.
Is she a first-generation immigrant, or was her family here for a long time?
I don't know what you'd call her, but I know that her great-grandparents came from Russia. Lithuania.
They're American.
I'm always confused as what to call me, you know, because I have one parent that's from a different country.
You know, maybe we don't need to put a thing on it, because
perhaps
that's the whole thing. It's like, you know, people put labels and whatever. But then again, I've had a lot of people on the show that are first generation, that their mm-hmm. parents are from, both their parents from the other country.
Yeah.
And the experience of growing up and wanting to become a creative person or an artist when you're first gen is so different than people whose heritage is more assimilated, that whose family have been in the country longer.
So with what you said, I feel like the people that I know who have grown up with, like, parents from different countries, seemingly there's definitely, like, a much bigger pressure for them to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
That's, like,
yeah, show me the money. Make the money.
That's a big, huge thing.
Do you speak Spanish?
I do speak Spanish. I am not fluent. I do have a good accent. But I will say I have been purposely going to Spanish-speaking countries so that I am, like, so that I speak more Spanish.
Yeah, that's something that
it's
I want to do,
so
too.
Important.
I consider myself one and a half lingual.
Okay.
You know, because I don't have vocabulary. My accent wavers.
Sure.
And it sticks in my craw. I feel
absolutely
like I should
it hurts. You know,
yeah, it does.
It does. So I personally feel with some of the Spanish-speaking countries I've gone to, I get, like, a warmer welcome when they see that I do want to speak Spanish.
Well, of course, people will always be receptive when they see that you're trying.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that will be across the board in anywhere you would travel. I mean,
yeah.
I think the thing that I have found, and I have not traveled extensively to Spanish-speaking countries. The only mm-hmm. I've been to Washington Heights. No. Spanish Harlem. No, I've been to Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
But I found that maybe this is just personal for me, that I've felt judged
mm.
for speaking Spanish like the American that I am. So let's get back to you and your origins. Do you have siblings?
I'm an only child.
You're an only.
I know. And it's so weird to hear people say this to me, but they will sometimes as a compliment. They'll go, you know, you just seem like you have siblings. And I know that they mean it as a compliment. Like, you're
that's
not
so
weird. And, like, you're not weird and selfish, which apparently is, like, a big...
Really? So I never found selfishness to be indicative of only children more than anybody else.
Huh.
No.
Oh, I don't think that that's true, but these are just stereotypes that I've heard of over the years.
Well, we must dispel all stereotypes now.
Yeah. I'm hoping I am breaking the stereotype.
Yes. Well, you know, by being a outspoken Latinx woman and an artist, you are redefining what being an artist means. So were you creative as a child? Did you have...
So in terms of creativity, I definitely liked writing from a young age. I still have some journals from when I was a kid. I wrote a lot of poetry, which I do not now, but I definitely really liked it then, and I do think perhaps it was, like, a sign of things to come, because it definitely took me a long time to find sort of what I really like, which seemingly it's storytelling. I love storytelling, and that's not something I always thought I would do. It also isn't necessarily a thing that was, like, even an option Until recently. Yeah. Exactly.
Did you think that you wanted to be some kind of performer or actor?
I think I did, yeah. So when I first moved to New York, the first thing I did was take a sketch class, which was, I didn't really like it that much. And then I took improv and I really didn't like that. And then on a whim, I saw that storytelling was an option at UCB. And then I thought, wow, this is great. And from there, I just went on in that direction.
So, like, high school, college, you didn't do creative things in school?
So, in my youth, though I did not necessarily do creative things in my youth, what I did do, which is explains a lot about me now and the things that I like and reference, I watched a lot of movies and a lot of TV growing up. Because I didn't do really any extracurricular activities, the sort of my Rolodex in my head of a lot of like movies and TV is quite large and has definitely for sure contributed to the direction that I went in. Because I was a huge TV and movie person. Then I went to school, my first two colleges, I was a psychology major. And then, which seems so insane to me now, because eventually I ended up coming to New York and going to school for like film and screenwriting.
What were some of the movies that influenced you or that stay with you now to this day?
The Birdcage. I love The Birdcage. I mean, that movie very much shaped like the fact that I love comedy. It definitely, I would say, is part of the reason I love the show Frasier, which is why I have a podcast called I'm Listening about the show Frasier, because I'm very much a fan of, like, hysterical, silly comedy, for sure. I also watched a lot of horror movies. I don't know what that says about me, but I know my mother was concerned.
Slasher movies?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've seen every Friday the 13th. I've seen every Halloween movie. I've seen every...
Are you into Cesar Romero? Pioneered the zombie movies?
Heck yes. Hell yes. I've probably seen everything in the zombie genre from Cesar Romero.
Wow. Do you still like horror movies?
For sure.
Yeah?
Yeah. If anything, I have developed a weird new habit where, in general, I never get joy out of, like, watching scary movies alone. Mostly because I don't like being scared alone. But more recently, when there are movies I really want to watch, the way I found around it is I have to watch a horror movie in the morning.
Ah, that's funny.
And I also like really silly, stupid horror movies. Those I get a lot of fun out of. I watched in the morning over the last few mornings as I've been getting ready for work. I've been watching a ridiculous movie called Friend Request, which is about like a witch that haunts people through her Facebook account. It's so stupid, but I can't get enough because it's so dumb.
I love how horror movies have really kept up with society and pop culture. Totally. I think almost more than any other genre.
Yeah.
Because like the first Halloweens came out when I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like you're reinventing that again for this generation.
For sure.
Yeah.
I totally agree with you. And you know what? I didn't even think of that until this moment. It's weird because, you know, I do love watching TV and movies, but currently, I don't like watching anything that's really sad. So, like, I like TV, especially given, like, our political climate. If anything, I'm always looking for something that is far away from real life. So I end up watching Frasier a lot, and I end up watching horror movies because if I'm really stressed out, it's like watching a horror movie makes you focus on the fear at hand. Am I saying it's healthy? I don't know, but I love horror movies.
Listen, it's the same way... Not the same way. It's relatively similar to people that will watch some kind of weird-ass reality show. Like Intervention or Hoarders.
Hoarders is a thing, for sure.
Yeah, so, like, you watch this show and you see how messed up these people are and you don't feel as bad about your life.
Yeah.
So, did you really pursue anything creative during your formative years, like in the times that you were in, like, from grade school up to college?
I mean, I hate to admit this, but, like, I was very lazy. I wouldn't say I tried. I wasn't a
boggle.
I wasn't a good student. And I was a terrible test taker. I took two AP classes and I did mediocre in both, like a B and a C. The B class was in a psychology class. And then when I took the whatever the test was at the end that you take for AP classes, I completely bombed it. And my teacher asked me, what happened? I said, I have no idea. I did terrible on the SATs. I never excelled in school, and I never really took off, in my opinion, until I left school. Mm. And that's where I started really making all of my connections.
Now, how was college for you?
So college was quite interesting. I'll talk a lot about this during my one-woman show, but I went to four different colleges, so I wouldn't say it was easy. I would say I had a lot of difficulty trying to find the thing that I really wanted to do, because I was very scared of starting over and not having my friends at my side. So the first two colleges I went to, I followed a best friend to their college of choice, which both mistakes. And I really started to excel once I left and really threw myself into finding my own.
So how many colleges did you go to, and what were their names, and what did you major in?
First, I went to LaSalle College, which is a small, not very good liberal arts college in Massachusetts. I was a psychology major. Then I went to the University of Connecticut as a psychology major. Then I dropped out. I went to Peru with my dad. I'd never been. He wanted to visit some of his family. That was a big deal for me because I'd never traveled really outside of the country, and I'd never really met, other than my dad and my grandparents, I'd never met this other side of my family.
Oh, wow.
I'd only just been around lots of white people. And so that was a really big
deal. Your dad didn't have any relatives in this country at all?
Other than his parents. And he had two half siblings in Fort Lauderdale, but we lived in Connecticut.
Right.
So yeah, it was
not around the corner.
Right. It was very isolating.
Did you grow up with your grandparents?
No. So what I did was I grew up with my parents, and then in the summertime I would go with my dad to visit my grandparents in Miami because they lived in Miami Beach, which was like being in a different country.
Yeah. No, I know. My grandparents lived in Hollywood, Florida. So,
oh,
you
wow.
know, yeah, yeah, yeah.
A lot of Spanish speakers in Miami.
Yeah.
Okay, so third college, technically, okay. So I dropped out of school, went to Peru, and then I wanted to see if I wanted to move to New York. And I thought, I'm broke, so how am I going to afford to see if I want to live in New York? So I'd like to say that I pulled a con on New York University. I took one credit in the summertime as an internship so that I could live in the dorms and have a meal plan, and it probably cost me about $1,200 for June, July, and August.
So who got scammed? You or them?
Them. It was my greatest scam. It was like, you know...
But $1,200 scam.
Well, technically, think about it. I'm paying $1,200 divided by 3. So what?
$400 a month, okay.
For food and rent.
Oh.
So NYU
ding, ding, ding,
100%
ding.
Got scammed by Anita, and I'm still very proud of that. And so during that summer, that was the summer of 2007, I lived in New York. I had two internships at production companies, and I took a sketchwriting class. And then I decided I liked New York. So then I applied to Brooklyn College. So I did have to move back home for about 5 months. And then 5 months later, I moved to New York to go to Brooklyn College. And that's where I graduated from.
Oh, and what were you majoring in there?
Film and television.
And were you always working in that field before you went to college?
Not at all.
So what made you decide to major in film and television? Did you have some kind of epiphany at some point saying to yourself, you know what, this is what I want to do?
I would say yes, I did have an epiphany, and it was definitely when I was at UConn. So for one thing, I was taking psychology, but any math and science classes I were taking, I was completely flunking because I'm not good with numbers. Separately from that, I thought, what is a thing that I love and always am thinking about and is always a part of my life? And I thought, oh, film and TV, for sure.
Right, because you watched movies all the
exactly.
time and TV shows.
And thankfully, I think it is a blessing that when I tried to see if UConn had like a film production major, they didn't. And then that was a huge turning point for me. And then I had a date with this guy who told me he was a psych major and that he was going to stick with it even though he was unhappy. Yeah.
And so, how old was he?
He was 20.
Oh my
God.
Were
both 20. And I was like, are you crazy, dude? This is the time. There, actually, any time is always the time. You should, like, it's very upsetting to me, the idea that you ever settle.
I would love to know what that man is like 10 years from now.
It is possible.
No, actually, I don't want to know what that man is like.
It's possible that he's a therapist and he has a lot of money and is unhappy.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
So, good money is wasted on rich people. That's what bums me out. coming to New York, I think I was always destined to come back here. My first year, I was very lonely, and that was very much because I was quite sure that this is how it was always going to be for me. And then at a certain point, I just forced myself to start doing activities that I liked. So I joined like the TV club, which was like a club for people that wanted to do TV production. And through that, I met basically all of my friends that I am still friends with to this day. And I graduated in 2010, which was 8 years ago. So I'm still friends with these people from college. But then I started to realize the majority of my friends that I am friends with now from college are all New Yorkers.
Really?
All New Yorkers.
So you found your home.
Absolutely.
You came back home. You're like the prodigal daughter.
Yeah. I mean, I felt like this has always been my home. And it's a very weird thing to remember that adolescence and the teen years were Connecticut. And honestly, I don't miss it even a little. Not even a little.
So when you graduated Brooklyn College, you had a bachelor's in film and TV?
Yes.
So what did you do with that? How did you parlay that into your work life? What happened next?
So I started working when I was 15. And I basically had the same job in Connecticut from 15 through college, which was this. I was a cheesemonger. What is a cheesemonger, you ask? It's a person that works at a cheese shop and cuts cheese. When I was finishing up college, at one point I was working 7 days a week. I want to bless the people that are doing this for longer than I did, which I did for 5 months because I wanted this internship so badly. I was an intern at the Colbert Report. That was like a huge turning point for me. It did not.
What year?
So that was 2010, and it did not pay. Let me tell you, I was working there 4 days a week. This was before it was illegal to not pay interns, and I knew I wanted this, but I also knew I needed to.
This is before he was on CBS. He was on Comedy Central, was he on?
He was on Comedy Central, yeah. So that was then. And so I wanted it so badly, and I thought, if I do this, I also have to be making money. And I remember when I accepted that internship, I also accepted the fact that I was going to be working the other days out of the week. I remember I cried. I was like, how am I going to do this? And then I just had to make myself a schedule of when I was going to do my laundry. And I worked 7 days a week for 5 months, which compared to many other people's probably not a big deal, but it was a big deal to me. So I did that. And then from there, I did a lot of production assistant work, like working for very small amounts of money on film sets for probably 3 years.
PAs, man.
Oh my God.
I have so much respect for PAs.
I mean, I had to get out of it because I was working on a lot of reality TV, and it is just the bottom of the barrel. I knew that I am, in terms of being an aggressive person, I'm not an aggressive person. And what I noticed, or mean, what I noticed is that a lot of people that would rise up from a PA to other things were very much like, yes, I'm aggressive, I'm getting in there, I'm being loud, I'm being whatever, I'm being brash, and like, that's just not in my nature. So what ended up happening was, eventually, I started working at a comedy website. I was making minimum wage.
Can you say the website?
It was called My Damn Channel. I was like a glorified intern, essentially. But it was the first time I worked in comedy, and that was really cool. During that time, I pitched my own series to them, which everyone can watch online. It's called Questionable Drawings. So Questionable Drawings was an animated web series. The animations were by me, and it's basically me drawing on a whiteboard. I would interview comedians and ask them questions, like weird questions, and animate their responses.
So you can draw?
Technically, no. If you watch these episodes, you will see that I have not a very good drawing ability, but That combined with these stories and combined with the fact that my friends would edit this for me and they would either speed up me drawing or turn it into stop motion gave it like some sort of like DIY charm. So I did that. Because I did that series, I think that is the reason I ended up getting my first full-time job, which was for a few years I was a social media manager. So that's basically just tweeting and like Facebooking.
Oh, that's so millennial.
I know. And so then I did that, and then I knew I didn't want to do that after a certain point. And then I'd say like probably the most exciting, you know, sort of like this is me going into a career was when I worked at Univision. I worked as a video producer at Flama. That was a site for Latinas.
Latinx. Yeah, I've heard of that one.
It's gone, as many media companies are just going down the toilet, which is really sad.
Is Me Too still a thing?
Me Too, it also just laid off 50% of their staff.
Oh, and like, my I think the God. CEO quit. Like, I used to see them post stuff all the time, and I haven't hardly seen them post anything.
Yeah, they let go.
That's too bad.
It's really sad.
That's
so... So that was a big deal for me. That was one of the best jobs I ever had.
Was it about this time that you started to pursue performance and comedy on your own by going to... You mentioned going to UCB earlier.
Yes. Performance and comedy, I would say I started probably 7 years ago.
Now, what sparked that in you? That you wanted to be front of camera as opposed to behind camera?
I think maybe what sparked that came from me taking... a sketch writing class 11 years ago. Because I took the sketch writing class, I did get frustrated with actual writing because that's still something I struggle with, just sitting down and forcing myself to write. But I had to go to a lot of shows at UCB. The reason I went to UCB was because I knew when I moved to New York, it was this like legendary institution.
Yes.
So I thought, I'm going to go into this blindly and I'm going to take a sketch class. After going to a lot of shows, I started to become envious of the actual performers. And then, so that was definitely in the back of my head. Then, when I interned at the Colbert Report, a friend of a friend asked me if I wanted to be a volunteer at a comedy festival in Brooklyn called the Eugene Merman Comedy Festival.
I've heard of that.
So I interned there in 2010. And then after that, I started doing a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff at comedy shows. And I really loved the scene and then there was this yearning that started to become.
So you were around stand-ups all the time?
All the time.
And did you ever try to do it?
So stand-up is something that I am still figuring out. I have been doing more stand-up in the last year, but it's definitely, like, I have been spoiled by the storytelling community because in my opinion, the storytelling community is very welcoming. And you go to a show and people just want to listen to you and they're not going, where's the joke? You know what I mean? And by nature, I want to be telling funny stories. And stand-up is very much like you have 5 minutes and you need to be funny consistently for 5 minutes.
Yeah, you need to have a joke every 10 seconds.
Exactly.
And there's like some like weird formula.
Right. And I just love to talk. So that is still something I'm figuring out. Yes.
So... here you are working behind the scenes at a lot of stand-up comedy shows.
Yeah.
What is the point where you discover that there's another art form called storytelling?
So that came in because I was going through UCB classes. So at that time, I was taking my cheese shop money, my money working at Uno's on 95th Street in Bay Ridge, and putting it towards these $400 classes at UCB. So I took sketch. I seemingly did not have the attention span to do that. Then I took improv, and I did not like it. And it was discouraging, but I still, even after I took this second improv class, I thought to myself, I know that I want to do comedy. I'm not going to give up. There's got to be other stuff. So my first storytelling class was with Margot
Lightman.
That was
my gosh, you're so amazing. And what made you want to take this class?
I think I wanted to take the class because I knew I was done with improv. I didn't want to do sketch and story, and I was very scared of stand-up. And storytelling seemed like a really gentle way of getting to continue to perform, but not necessarily with the same kind of pressure that stand-up and improv has.
It's so funny that so many people say that storytelling is the kinder, gentler comedy. It's so funny.
It is. And, you know, so I took that class with her, and there was a bit of a lag in between, because I was still in college at the time, between her class, and then I took David Crabb's class. And that was a bigger turning point.
So you were part of the Crabb Lab.
I was part of the Crabb Lab. Oh my God, I loved the Crabb Lab. I loved it.
Okay, you've taken the storytelling class at UCB. What is the point that you decide to start doing it?
Man, I feel like I really started performing a lot more after Natalie Wall, who is also a comedian slash storyteller, she asked me to join the sort of comedy tour or comedy group that she created. It's called Awkward Sex in the City. So this is a traveling group of comedians that go to cities probably in the East Coast-ish area, I would say. That's as far as I've traveled with them. And it's stories about like dating, sex, and romance. So she asked me, she had already been doing this tour with other comedians for a year. Then after that, she reached out to me, and it was very unbelievable timing because I had a job at the time. This was several years ago. I had just lost a job. I was very upset about it. And in the same week found out I have talked about this, so this is not a sensitive area for me, but I found out I had this tumor in my uterus and that I was going to have it removed.
Oh dear.
And then it might be cancerous. It turned out it was not cancerous, but I still had to have major surgery. So she reached out to me during this terrible, terrible week. And it was just so, it meant so much to me that this other person that I loved and respected wanted to do comedy with me. So, and then I joined this tour, and fortunately our first show was after I had had months to recover from the surgery, but I was still very like wobbly and just like finding my way back. And I remember we did this show at Black Cat, which is a theater in DC, and it was sold out. There were hundreds of people there. It was easily the greatest performance I've ever done and experienced in my entire life. And from then on, I feel like I have just wanted to repeat that. Mm. So like having that, and maybe this is something you can relate to, but like there's just a high of like knowing that people like think you're funny and like what you're saying and are engaged. That just, it makes me always want it even more.
Yes, that feeling is just so amazing. You just took off with storytelling and you never looked back.
Yeah, I would say I've been pretty consistent. And Vanessa Valeria, who is definitely an inspiration to me.
And she's your co-producer now.
She's my co-host. She moved to Denver, but she's coming to do our monthly show in September. So I'm really excited to reunite with her.
Which is called Party of Two.
Party of Two. It's, you know, stand-up and storytelling about dating in New York. So you always get some really good stories and some good stand-up. We've been doing our show for 2 years. We have a following. It's amazing. Having like a consistent show is a very good motivator to continue performing.
So a little Pescao says that you have a little excerpt to share from your solo show called College Sucks.
I absolutely do. So I very much wish that somebody had told me, had given me advice before starting my college journey. As a result of me going to four colleges, I feel that I have much wisdom to share with anyone listening who is thinking about where they're going to go to college. So I have a few pieces of advice for you. Number one, do not go to your best friend's fourth choice college. That is a mistake. I think depending on where you go to school, you're going to feel really pressured to immediately leave your home and go off and go to whatever college will take you. But guess what? Private college, we're talking $60,000, $70,000 a year. So really think about what you're doing. Maybe go to community college and then decide if you want to go to the school that you want to go to. And also you'll have a chance at community college to get those grades up. So that's my first piece of advice. So I did follow my best friend at the time to her fourth choice school. So that's my, here's another piece of wisdom. If you can avoid it, do not live in a room with three other people. It's a lot. It's a lot. I lived with three other women and very quickly came to discover that we were living in a room that was not meant to be a room. It was in the basement of a former sanitarium. Sanitarium is an old-timey word for mental institution. So, you know, from far away, honestly, it sounds like a very sort of sexy synopsis for some sort of horror movie with sexy teen or sexy co-eds. But in reality, it was really a lot of mental breakdowns because we all realized we'd made a mistake coming to this college. A centipede infestation. You want to see a horror movie? That's a horror movie. A centipede infestation. And we also didn't have anyone else on our floor because we were in the basement. So it wasn't a great opportunity to, say, make friends. So that was another mistake. Avoid it. Another thing I would say, learn from this, come up with your signal of somebody is going to have sex in the dorm room. You need the signal, as in a scrunchie, you know, something on the door that says, don't come in. My three roommates and I never had that conversation. So on Halloween night, I remember coming back to my dorm room. On the whiteboard, there was a blob on the whiteboard that I found out later was supposed to be a penis. Regardless, tell me that the penis signifies that you're having sex. We never had this conversation. So I walked into that room and came in to see not one, but two of my roommates having sex with their own separate gentlemen. And I think the weirded extra level of weirdness there was the fact that everyone was wearing their Halloween costumes because it was Halloween. So, you know, you had guy dressed like Mr. Peanut, you know, just making sweet love, we'll call it sweet love, to drunk 18-year-olds, to a woman dressed as a French maid. You know, it was weird. And I, when I'm in these uncomfortable situations, I feel as if I need to I need to talk my way out of it. So then I'm talking to them, I'm saying, wow, this is uncomfortable, isn't it? Then I start talking about this party I just came from, and that's another lesson. People don't want to make small talk while they're mid-intercourse, you know? And so at a certain point, things are still happening that are sexual in that room, and at that point, I just ran out of the room. So yeah, that's another lesson for you. I think those are all the lessons I can probably give you right now from my excerpt. But I would say my biggest takeaway from all of this is really think hard before you sign off on a loan to Sallie Mae. Because what they're going to do is send you the amount of money you owe after you graduate. And you think, what? I never would have signed off on this loan for $10,000. Then they send you a picture of your signature. And it is truly frightening. So those are my lessons for anyone listening right now.
And that was an excerpt from College Sucks.
That's right.
So we'll have to keep our eye on them when you're going to be doing that show again.
Absolutely.
So did you see how hard I was like trying not to laugh audibly?
I did.
Oh,
I
my
did.
God. Why people don't want to make small talk when in mid-intercourse. So, Anita, do you feel that your family supported your creative pursuits when you were younger doing them? And if not, do they accept them and are glad of it now?
I would say neither one of my parents ever said, no, don't do this thing. I think they've always, I recognize that is fortunate that I also was never in a situation where I had to fit, like, financially support my parents either. You know, granted, they didn't have any money, and that's fine. It very much instilled in me, like, the importance of saving up money. I'm not saying it's easy to not have money and pursue your creative passions. It's going to take work. It's going to take effort. It might even take working 7 days a week. But if you're really passionate, it is totally worth it. And I'm grateful that I have parents that never discouraged me from doing the things that I love. Lily.
Anita, I asked this of everybody when we come to the end of our chat together. If you had any tidbit of advice or word of encouragement for a child who feels that they want to be creative and maybe their family is against it or they don't know how because they don't come from an environment that supports that, but they have this burning idea to be something more than the constraints of their life seems to think that they have the right to be, what would you tell this child?
So I would tell this child, because I can definitely relate to that. I mean, even just coming from that kind of background, you do, I think it comes from a place of love when you do have family members that don't support you because often they think you're going to fail. But what I would say is it's time, you're going to have to step out of your comfort zone a little bit. I know that I had to do that. And that means you're going to have to reach out and try and find like-minded people. And there are different ways to do that. I mean, especially in New York, you know, things have also changed for the better, I would say, for women. I want to say more people of color. It's a very slow progression, but I would say get out of your comfort zone. Do your best to find people that have similar interests to you, whether it be through, you know, Facebook, Twitter, meetups. And if you're trying to do comedy, like go to an open mic, find one that is specific towards people of color and or women. And stay after those open mics and talk to people, get to know people, exchange information.
In real life.
In real life.
Because even though how much social media has taken over our lives, in the interactions you have in real life are the ones that actually count the most.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Anita, you are so wise. I'm so happy you were in Fish Out of Agua. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Hug on the air.
Hug on the air.
We always end with a hug on the air.
This is a lovely hug.
Woohoo!
And I think that you have a career in doing ASMR videos. We'll be right back.
kiss her. Oh, I'm giving it my all, but I'm not the guy you're taking home. Ooh, I keep dancing on my own. I keep dancing, oh yeah. I'm in the corner watching you kiss her. Oh, I'm right over here. Why can't you see me? Oh, I'm giving it my all, but I'm not the guy you're taking home. Ooh, I keep dancing on my own. I keep dancing on my
And we're back with Fish Out of Agua on Radio Free Brooklyn. A little bit that got lost from Anita Flores' interview was how to find her. So you can contact her. She's Anita Jutina on both Twitter and Instagram. She's Anita Jutina at Weebly.com for her website. And she's Anita Flores on Facebook. Like her on Facebook. Follow her on Twitter and Instagram. Book her for a show because she's fabulous. Yes, she is. The song that you just heard was another one of Anita's picks. It was by Robin. It's called Dancing on My Own from her Body Talk Part 1 album in 2010. So we have a little bit of announcements before we get to the end of the show. How would you like to see Brooklyn represented at South by Southwest next year, huh? If you agree with having Radio Free Brooklyn being known by the entire world, just get us to Austin's South by Southwest conference next spring so we can present Pirate Radio version 3.0. It's easy to vote. All you have to do is sign up, and they don't ask you for any money or anything. Just go to radiofreebrooklyn.org/SXSW and vote for us. Because everyone should know what Brooklyn sounds like. Well, kids, that's our show. You have been listening once again to Fish Out of Agua on Radio Free Brooklyn. We're going to close with the last of Anita Flores' picks. It's by Tamia. It's called So Into You, and it's from her self-titled album, Tamia, from 1998. Stay tuned for Brooklyn Bandstand next, and we'll see you next week. Woohoo!